Today is Thursday, the 1st of September, 2011. This recording is of David Carroll, and it is being made in Andover, New Hampshire.
Well, I was born in a central Pennsylvania town, a railroad town, and a fairly large city now, I guess. And I had no connection with the natural world. Everything I knew, as I write in Self-Portrait, the first 8 years, it was a totally human-centered world. Everything was centered around the problems within the family unit. There was a big family, many relatives, that sort of thing. And everything revolved around the getting of the daily bread and the reading of the evening newspaper. And I had a backyard, and we were in difficult economic situations. And I was in a church school kind of a situation, so everything was really family and church and community, which to some people is the ideal life and their salvation. For me, even though that I was only there for those 8 years, as an 8-year-old, I had already begun to feel that there must be something else to life. I can't exactly imagine. I'd love to try to think back to exactly how I perceived it as an 8-year-old. But then family circumstances arose in which essentially my father ran away and joined the Navy, and then persuaded my mother to come and join him, and their marriage wasn't going very well. I knew that. I had a brother who was a year younger than me. But anyway, through that background of circumstances, she decided to join him. Big decision for her to leave all of that. But for me, it was this amazing liberation, because I arrived in southeastern Connecticut in 1950 as an 8-year-old, and away from all of that particular environment, human environment, and we were living in a sort of a housing project with a lot of other Navy families and some other people who were non-Navy, but I didn't know anybody. It was just my third day in town, and it was in early June, and I was looking out from my backyard sort of late in the afternoon, and I saw these trees in the distance, and they really appealed and beckoned to me. I saw woods, and I had not known woods, so I decided I would just take a little slip away from my mother's watchful eye. Walked along this, there was a big chain link fence there. This is all now Charles Fizer Chemical Corporation. At the time it was a much smaller thing. But anyway, I walked around the edge of their property, which was chain-link fenced, went along the edge of the woods, and I saw this stream running through the woods, and that beckoned to me even more than the woody kind of red maple swamp habitat that I was to know in my future, know by name anyway. And then I went across the brook on these stones, and found this backwater marsh with a lot of reedy growth in it, and here I was beginning to really immediately become in the thrall of this natural little place I was in, with birds and dragonflies and frogs leaping around. And then I saw some movements in the grassy, reedy growth in the water, and it was like I was expecting something incredible to happen at any moment. I was just, as I said in my book, I think, I don't think my senses were ever so keen. I just felt like everything was coming to life, that what I was seeing and hearing and touching. And I looked, and this turtle emerged into a clear place in the water. And I didn't know what kind of turtle it was at the time. But here was this incredibly beautiful black-shelled turtle with these bright yellow spots on it and these bright orange markings along the side of her head. And that turtle just centered everything for me. At that moment, literally that moment of seeing that turtle in that situation galvanized everything. It just became a center of the focus. And I was shaking all over. I thought, I've got to catch this turtle and look at it and hold it. And so I went into the water, shoes and all, picked up the turtle and held it in my hands. And that experience of looking at that living thing and holding it in my hands opened up a world to me that I could not have imagined existed, really. And not in so many words, I'm sure, as an 8-year-old, what it represented was an entrance into a world that I was never going to leave, and it was a passkey into that world, and it was a key, a way of opening a door that was would allow me to leave what I had to leave behind. So it was like a crossing, a transition. It's very, very hard to understand how all of that could have happened, but it really did on that one evening. I went home, late for supper, wet shoes, not good. Mom and I would have battled that for the next 10 years or so. But then from then on, it was just a matter of going back at every chance I could get. I've read about other naturalists and artists and so on, and indeed, it does seem that there is a, I kind of shy away from the word epiphany, but there's a truly pivotal life experience. A direction opens up at a very early age. E.O. Wilson at 7 years old, I'm trying to remember, I think it was a jellyfish. It almost doesn't matter what it is, but to that young mind, I guess, and that newly forming imagination, if there are receptors within, you know, one of the things I think that was so key about my personal experience was that I didn't have a guide. You know, I hadn't been on Boy Scout hikes. I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have, you know, the nature guru. And I'm not saying that those are not good things. I'm just saying that it just so happened that all of this happened to me alone in that time and space and that chunk of natural world, which to a small boy, 8, who had never seen anything like it, was a universe, really. And I have given many talks to all ages, and I've gone into schools, and I'm in, you know, second and third grade. I was about to go into third grade that fall. I look at those little people, and they are little people, of course, and I think, was that really me? Was that really me? And it surely was. And it was a very, very personal, independent thing within myself. That I then began to carry forward. I didn't seek a guide or mentor, really. I began to look into books. I began to read about turtle. The turtle was really a key focus, and then that really sort of led to what I was going to go on and do in art and writing and so forth, as well as the natural history part of my life. That was in June, that was in summer, so it was not going to be until September I'd be going into third grade, and I was going to be going into the public school system, which I have a great reverence for. I also see some other sides to it, both because I was a student and then I taught, but I just can't back it in general enough because I had such remarkable teachers. But that whole summer, I was, again, just constantly going back to these swamps, constantly looking to find these turtles to come to understand and see more about their world and what it was. But it was all very intuitive. I mean, at that time, I wasn't thinking about looking for a book on turtles. I wasn't thinking about looking for a book on wetland botany, for heaven's sakes, of course not. But then when I went into school, that was that private part of my life. But it began to evolve. When I was in school, the teachers began to recognize my abilities, my innate talent, which I'm extremely fortunate to have. I mean, these are gifts. What you do with your talent, you can take some credit for, but you can't take credit for the talent, which is absolutely a gift, a chance of thing. And that gift of finding that first turtle, well, I went in with this mixture within myself, and teachers began to recognize and support the innate talent and encourage me quite a bit. And at first, it was mostly the science teachers, because I would tell them about what I was doing and where I went and what I saw. And some of them actually came to my house to visit. This is now I'm in fifth, sixth grade even, because I had what were called vivariums. I would build these little natural habitats and keep a frog, a toad, a snake, a turtle for a while and take it back and let it go. And one teacher in particular just took me under his wing, sixth and seventh grade, and he felt I had enormous talent in science. He saw a career in maybe medical research or something that I did not go into, but he saw that science part, and he really wanted to foster that. And he just told me flat out, talking to me, this little kid, saying, you know, I want to get your name in the newspaper as much as I can. I want to help you get scholarships. I want you to go on. And That was pretty remarkable. I went to visit him and his wife at their house, and he was just became a friend and mentor in that sense. Still, when I was out there in the swamps and all, I was alone. That was what I did. And then, in sixth grade, a teacher in particular at that time saw what I was doing with writing, my English teacher, Mr. Moxley. I remember him so well. I remember all these teachers so well. Unfortunately, most of them were... It took me so long to get my first book contract, they did not live to see that. I wish they had. I really wish... And some did. And that was a great, wonderful thing. But he really encouraged my writing. And so now I'm thinking, okay, I have these abilities and these teachers are encouraging me. The art part of it really didn't kick in until I was a freshman in high school much, because I had teachers, the art teachers, the art programs before that were mostly cut and paste things. I don't know. It wasn't art with a capital A is the only way I can explain it. But I was recognized as a kid with the talent. I got to do the bulletin board for President's Day, and my drawings were always up on the wall, that kind of thing. And that's no small thing. That was great. But then I met this incredible man, Bill Miller, who was to become a friend and mentor in art and life, for life, a long life, a long time. And shortly after I went into the high school art, and it was his first year teaching in the high school, he was 40, and he had a young wife who, she was 20, I was 15, but they welcomed me. He brought me home to his house. And then as my adolescence unfolded, I began to spend really more time there than I did really in my own home. But he taught without teaching. He was a remarkable man. What art really was all about and what the life of the artist could be. So as I got into, and then in my junior year, my English teachers in high school were very, they became personal friends of mine, one in particular, my junior year teacher, who also introduced me to the work of Thoreau, which was huge. And so I had this Mr. Nelson and Mr. Chick and Mr. Miller, and a biology teacher who also was sort of grooming me, but it was beginning to become apparent, I guess, that I was going to shift more in the art direction. And it wasn't until my senior year that I could really... I was taking exams and looking for a scholarship in biology to go on that in that direction, but I was thinking very much of submitting a portfolio and going the art school way. And towards the end of the... well into my senior year, I decided, yes, I'm going to apply to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And it was the only school I applied to for art. I got accepted, and I decided that would be my route. And that was the best route at the time. But the biology, the things I do on my own, have always, always been there. And then over this long evolution in my book era, beginning when I was 45, I had this background that I had built on my own, really. I didn't have a biology course after high school. But that became a very central thing, and that entered, of course, into my natural histories that I wrote and to the field work that I was doing with the turtles. So I was part still just wandering, wide-eyed, 8-year-old boy, but then I began to be more data recording naturalist also, and then blending the art in with that. And I really should add that as when I went to the Museum School of Fine Arts, I then decided, well, you know, I just want to be a painter. I just want to be an artist. So I wasn't interested in the academics. The museum school had a wonderful program whereby one could also apply to Tufts after the first year and do academics. Well, at the end of that first year, I thought, well, you know, I would like to continue with Spanish. I would like to continue with English lit and writing and so forth. So anyway, I did apply and got accepted to Tufts, and that meant I would be in school for 5 years. But there at Tufts in particular, I ran into incredible professor friends, and several of whom became close friends of mine, introducing me to Oriental art and music. And my English teacher I had for 2 years, professor, was hugely supportive of my writing. And then Juan Alonso, the Spanish teacher, was big on that too, and that Spanish has always been a big part of what I've done in my head and my thinking and so forth. And so with this blend, I did finish the school years, and then was fortunate enough to get a teaching job and began that. So that was my urban era, 5 years in Boston, during which I was out in the fens a lot, finding all kinds of turtles from all over the world because people dumped them in there from the pet shops and so on. But I knew, once I was out of school, I just needed to find a place where I could be in that kind of landscape setting where all of this had first happened to me as an eight-year-old. And I knew that that landscape was gone from where I first experienced it. And that sense of loss has never left me. I think today of the old swamp, I think, as I called it, and of that stream along the railroad tracks and so forth, and this this old farm land that had these vernal pools with spotted turtles. But that was going, gone, and I knew it. So I was in southeastern Mass, and I had some nice places there, but I could see after a year or two of teaching there, I said to my wife, Lorette, that, you know, this is going to be like where I came from in Connecticut in another 5 years. We've got to get out of here. I moved north, and it's been that kind of a long odyssey where I just, my moves have been landscape driven. The most important thing to me wasn't where, you know, obviously I had to have some kind of a job, and teaching was the way to go. And I love teaching also. I felt I could repay somewhat, perhaps, what my teachers had given me. But I was mainly looking for a place where I could just disappear and go find those experiences where I could feel myself as I have always needed to feel that I am part of all of those things I saw, that I'm part of that pattern. And of course, our species has that evolution where most of us are very distanced from that now because of what human life has come to represent on the planet. And it certainly is quite human-centered. But I felt most alive when I was where, I mean, the thing that I always remember is the minute I go through a screen of alders or willows or something like that, I feel everything being brushed off me, physically and mentally and spiritually, I guess, just brushing off. And then, you know, it's like I pass through this screen. And then suddenly, if I'm not, I am a human being, obviously, you know, I can't. And I don't mind that. That's a nice thing to be on a good day. But I felt that I was in the presence of time and natural working. And all of these things were so related to each other in a way that was magnificent. And I could not be related in the same way, but I could be as much a part of it as I could just by standing there even. Or, as I believe I wrote, a witness to it. I could bear some, or I could just be in its presence. Being in its presence was just huge. And I suppose, yeah, obviously, I must say, I was constantly looking at the patterns of leaves because I was identifying plants, but also because they were beautiful. I started doing little hand-bound books with studies of winter buds of trees. I did a huge series of wildflowers and things like that. I drew tree bark. I felt trees with my hands. I just, the patterns, the images, and those, even though a lot of my art after art school and so forth was to become something more from my own imagination, cubist and even surrealist things, let's say. Paul Klee was a big influence with his magic square paintings. But Klee always felt a strong connection with nature, no matter how his work evolved from his own mind. I mean, he didn't want to paint what the Impressionists were painting, but that natural world was an influence on him. Nature in the broadest possible sense, with a capital N. So that obviously is an influence in, well, it's very obvious when I'm doing the winter bud studies, and I did botanical art for quite a while. But then also when I'm doing just simply these squares of color and light and dark, that's all what I'm, you know, I'm constantly moving in and out of sun and shadows, and I just stand there and try to blend in as much as I can. I'm in and out of water. I'm in and out of water from the time there's a little opening in the ice to when it freezes over again. And so those patterns are always, always around me, and I'm moving through them. And I think, how fortunate I am to be as much a part as I am of it. And I really think it's pretty central that happened to me so unbidden, so deeply at such a young age. Because I don't know that can be imparted, really. And I think as time, you know, as your human life goes on, I think whatever those receptors that I had were and have been kept alive, they may have started to close off. Like all the things we do in our life demand certain attentions and certain talents and certain functions, and of necessity that means some must be left behind. So somehow by going back there, I guess that's an interesting thought. By going back there, I think I'm keeping those alive. That's very important. Singleness of purpose. Oh man, I just found a wonderful word for that in German, and I'm forgetting it. But singleness of purpose, I guess, was really always a part of my makeup. And you know, I mean, I did play ball. I played softball or wiffle ball a lot when I was a kid, here and there. But that swamp part of me that I kept going back to, you know, and as even as an adolescent, you know, well, okay, now we've got girls to think about. There are parties. There's being cool. If you can, they enter the equation. But that never dissuaded me, and in a way, it's an interesting thought. But when I was in high school and all, and when I was in that mix, of course, of the you know, the preliminary mating game and all of that, I was, and even in elementary school, I was encouraged by my teachers, and though kids might have made fun of me in one way or another. We all suffered those various things, but for some reason that turtle-headed part of me was always respected. And that's really carried through to this day. I mean, people, oh, you're the turtle man, they'll say. And I'll say, well, I've been called worse. But it's true. And these people, that was not a part of their life. They couldn't understand that. I had a friend who came with me and went on to become quite a biologist. I influenced him in that direction. He was quite a good, but he was really a very much a hardcore scientist. I was more a wandering, whatever it was. But it was not understood. But it was, you know, nobody said, well, what the hell's the matter with you? You know, what do you, you know, it, with the family, it was a little, well, Mom, of course, was always a tough challenge because she had ideas and yins are going to be something. She never said exactly what, but I don't think it was, you know, a turtle catcher. But what do you do out there all that time, she would say. And isn't your house good enough? When I was real little, you know, why don't you stay here? Why don't you stick to your yard? So those kinds of things were there, mostly through Mom. But I, you know, I was fortunately very, very immune to that. That just rolled off me like water off a duck's back, and I just went on about that, and I never, and then when I met, you know, Lorette, and we got married, we had kids, out I went. Summers, teacher, I wasn't, you know, we were getting by on my teaching salary, which was not much at all, of course, and all the other teachers would get summer jobs and so forth, but no, I was in the swamps, and I was writing, and I was drawing. Maybe because I was writing and drawing too, that people thought, well, he's somewhat useful, or he's employed at something anyway. But to me, I didn't care. Just to be out there. I mean, what are you going to do today? I'm going to go to the swamp. Well, good grief. I remember talking to a woman that first year I was teaching in Southeastern Mass. And we stopped at an antique shop one day. And as I was talking to her, she said, oh, you teach at Silver Lake. My son is the such and such a teacher there this summer, you know. He's going to be working, painting houses. What are you going to be doing? And, you know, I said, well, I'm not going to be working. Oh, she said, well, you're taking courses then. You're professional improvement. And I'm thinking, no. I said, I'm going to be, and then it came to me, I said, furthering my eccentricities. She said, that is so refreshing to hear. But I did that. And yes, that was difficult. I mean, the economics of my life, pre-MacArthur certainly, and the books have opened been helpful. They don't make money in themselves. They've opened doors for lectures and so on. But and my wife was a painter also. So here we are, two freelance artists who, I had a child and a child on the way when I was getting out of college. I had two children before I had a car. So this takes an unusual wife, of course. I mean, if she was looking for the any kind of car, never mind a new car, or a washing machine, or a dishwasher, or a house, that's wasn't going to happen. And but that that she never never skipped a beat. I mean, that's, oh, where are you going? I'm going out to the swim. Okay, good, good for you. You know, I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty rare. That's pretty rare. I mean, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have lasted very long at all. And then we adopted a third child, but I still, you know, I was teaching, you know, in those days. Then I was out of teaching. Everything was freelance. And boy, I'll tell you, it was mighty, mighty lean for a long, long time. But we always, you know, again, we found a beautiful place to live. I found a place where I could go to the swamps and streams. We had our art. We survived. It was, it's nothing romantic about, you know, I don't think poverty is a good friend of artists and poets. You know, a lot of them go through that, but or musicians or anybody. But anyway, we you know, we had, and I often think, you know, as my kids are well grown now and so forth, but as they were older, young adults, and they were very independent too. I always described our family as a loose pre-Garibaldi Italy, a loose federation of independent city-states, and I think that worked for. Well, it worked for me. Obviously, again, that singleness of purpose. But they would say, "Ah, what do you mean? You know, you wish you could have provided a little bit more. We had such a great life. We had a rich life, and it was rich. It was really. I mean, we were below the Puerto Rican poverty line, I would say, and getting by. And luck, people who helped us out, people who rented places for very, very little." And then a woman who even left us a house. I mean, you know, I've had extraordinary luck. That is, I never deny that. And luck has to be part of anybody's equation, I think. But I remember calling my mother when Swamp Walker's Journal came out, my third book. And I had sent her a copy. And I said, "Did you get the?" "Oh, yes, yes, I got the book." She said, "You know, I have to hand it to you, David." She said, "You were always so bullheaded. You were always so self-centered." I said, "Mom, how could I have done this if I weren't bullheaded and self-centered?" Then I could have added, "How could I have survived you if I weren't bullheaded and self-centered?" And in a way, this is true. She was a difficult person, and it was rougher on my siblings than on me because I had that singleness of purpose, and I just let stuff roll off me. I just thought, "No, you know, that's, I'm going this way." Maybe that's a little turtly, I don't know. My concern really for the environment, it's an odd word, I guess, you know, environmentalists, it can be anybody who picks up waste paper from the side of the road or one thing or another, but to me, my dedication or my, I mean, I almost wrote this in my book, but I thought, nah, it's a little too quaint, but I made a promise to Froggy. I made a promise to Froggy when I was like 10 or 11 years old. I saw this frog in a swamp. There was a bulldozer perched by it. Already a big chunk of where I used to go was eradicated, and there was like the steel structure of a three-story industrial building going in. And I remember, it was like in November, and it was getting very cold. This was in Connecticut, so it wasn't like New Hampshire. And I just saw that there was this one last frog I saw in the swamp that wasn't down and, you know, ready for winter and all of that. And I was just overwhelmed. The emotions were so strong. And I even thought about some eco-terrorism, maybe throwing some sand in the engine of this bulldozer or whatever. But I knew that I wouldn't stop anything. And I just looked at that frog and I thought, you know, I'm going to do something about this somehow. Well, and that was a real true story. And I've always felt that way. And as these things have gone, I have felt this tremendous sense of loss, and that's echoed in my books. It just has to be there. I live it all the time. And so as things went on, and then I got the books that really opened me up to an audience, a big audience, actually. And I began to give talks and put the books out themselves. As a matter of fact, when I received that first contract in August of 1986, I believe it was, I said, the minute I signed that contract, I said to my wife, Lorette, you know, this means a turning. I am going to leave off a lot of the kinds of art that I've been doing. This is going to allow me to be a voice. This is going to allow me to have an influence. I mean, I just saw that. I hadn't written the book yet. I had a proposal, and I had the ideas very well formed in my mind, and I did, and I had books that I thought might follow it. But and it was kind of a leap to think this was going to do it, but I just saw it that way. And I said to her that, yes, with all, you know, we know all about the human suffering in the world. You know, it's inexcusable, the starvation, the war, and so forth. But look at history. It's a straight line with our species. And, I would like to be an influence of a better day there, too. But to me, the most critical thing I saw was what our species was doing to all the other species on the globe and to the landscape, to the ecology, the natural landscape. And I said, this is going to allow me to be a voice. So I saw myself making a very, very conscious decision. I thought the greatest need was to bring to people's attention what this world really was like, because most people hadn't experienced it, of course, in the way I had. Many have, but I mean, take the whole species as a whole, that many have not. Earlier cultures certainly did a great deal more. But the Aborigines and so forth. But anyway, I saw that, and she regretted that. She said, you know, you do some of the best artwork I can imagine, and I hate to see you leaving that off. And I felt, well, you know, art is going to be done, good, bad, and indifferent art. There are going to be some good artists that will be produced. But I felt that this was an area that just didn't seem to have... Yes, there was Rachel Carson, and of course there were people addressing issues. A lot of them, and this is not to put any of that down, but a lot of them, again, out of that human concern. Certainly DDT was impacting the raptors and so forth, but also there was this chemical, you know, what we were doing to our own environment and poisoning our own species, which we're still doing. But at any rate, I just thought, I just want to speak for Froggy. I want to speak for the turtle, for that natural world. So that became a real goal and a mission. And in a way, that drove me through these books. Originally, I just wanted to celebrate and share this world I had found. But by the time I got that book contract, I saw a lot of what happened. Of course, I had already left several places behind I knew I could never go back to find that. It was gone. And so that became a very compelling issue for me. And I thought of it apart from human concerns. Great, you know, we're learning not to go to the bathroom in our drinking water. Good for us. But what are we doing to these so many other species and so on? So that that evolved, and I began to get I became very proactive in various. I devoted at least a half a year of my life to help battle the Nashua Circumferential Highway project in southeastern New Hampshire. People called me up and said, "Can you come? Can you help?" And that's where I, and it was one of the rare instances where the U.S. EPA was taking a strong stand against this project because of its impacts, not just to the human communities in the area, but to the natural community. And so that's where I respected the fact that they were finally going to use their veto. That's almost impossible today. The politics have shifted so brutally. But anyway, when I saw an opening like that, I would jump in because by then I had a voice and I had enough recognition. I was sought after to do this. But it was all non-paying. It was Crusader Rabbit stuff. And I remember one time the group sent me home with a couple of bags of groceries, which was very nice. And then I actually got contracted by EPA and the National Park Service to do specific studies and make reports and recommendations. I was very involved for over a 10-year period, sometimes a great deal of the time in the active season, on the Lamprey River Wild and Scenic Designation Project. But I saw the wheels falling off the cart there, too, but I was part of it. So on I went. I got an EPA Environmental Merit Award. My book, Swamp Walkers Journal, won the Burroughs Medal. I was getting these wonderful recognitions and accolades and hero of conservation here and there and that kind of thing, which, again, enabled me. And then I began to give a lot of talks, and many, many talks. I've given many talks. So that ruled for a number of years as my book era was going along. So I was writing the books, I was fighting these campaigns, I was doing my artwork, and I was spending as much time again in my own places that I love to be to follow the turtles. It has come to the point where I've fought some of my last battles. I feel I've lost a real big one where I had hoped, it looked like through various agencies and so forth, a key habitat block that could have been 2,000 to 4,000 acres and was originally termed an ecosystem reserve project, ended up becoming more or less a farmy conservation project with a huge agenda for human access and use in recreational ways and so forth. And my big campaign has become to try to speak to saying, where do we leave something alone? Where is something really left for the natural ecology, for the functioning of an ecosystem that's, you know, got the biodiversity in it that we all say we need to support, that we can, you know, where can we leave something alone and walk away and not say, all the money that, you know, you look for grants for conservation money, you can't get the money if you don't open the land to public use. You can't do, you know, and that sticks in my craw pretty brutally. I mean, I hate the fact that we always think that way. And so, but I support those initiatives, but I try to, well, the way I put it is we need to go well beyond stewardship, which is all, say, Great Britain has. We need to go beyond stewardship to conservation. We need to go beyond conservation to preservation. And I call myself a preservationist. But that, even in the conservation community, that's not particularly welcome. Sweetwater Trust sent me a draft of their Forever Wild easement they were trying to bring forth into the conservation battles, but they drew a lot of flack for that because the plank was that these would be set aside. They wouldn't be for, you know, horseback riding and taking your dog for a walk and mountain biking and kayaking. So I began to think more and more, and my own experience showed me that places that weren't eliminated outright, paved over and so forth, were so marginalized or so put into human service of one kind or another that they really were human theme parks, they were human playgrounds. And there's a real big difference between an area that is exempt from public haunt, a beautiful, beautiful line from Shakespeare, and the places that everybody feels that, oh, well, if you buy up the development rights and you exclude wheeled vehicles, you've won the battle and it's good for the wildlife. Well, it is, up to Point X, but the wildlife doesn't come first. I just want to see that happen. Consequently, it's become more and more difficult for me to give talks because I see that a lot of what I'm advocating and working toward is inapplicable. It's just not going to happen. And I could give 100 talks a year, and it wouldn't change that. But I'm not. I cannot. Obviously, I can't walk away from this, and I don't want to walk away from this. But I also feel, as I look at my bucket of days, there are things I want to do in my life. There are things I can affect. There are things I cannot affect. So I tend to give talks now if they are of what I call political consequence, you know, where I'm speaking to a different audience that I think has some political will that might change things, or there are very few like this, but that are economically rewarding so that it can help support my work. Most of the stuff I've done an awful lot pro bono, of course, because a lot of people who want to hear what I have to say are not heavily funded groups, and it's also a very difficult thing for me too, because I can rant and rave on my own. I rant and rave. But when I'm giving a talk, I can be ambassadorial because often I'm speaking to a land trust group. And so I'm, you know, many times I've been a keynote speaker. And I follow the people who've put their family farm into a conservation easement, people who hold up their children and say, I did this for my children's children's children. And then, you know, I get to be the Iceman cometh. I'm going to say, you know, this is, and I say this sincerely and genuinely. I appreciate the sacrifice, you know. You could have had the millions, the money, the work you put into it, the work the conservation agency did, and so on. But when you get, and I talk to the land trust, and I say, when you evaluate these areas, if you can acquire them, if you have a significant habitat block, if you have a high degree of true ecological, natural function, and biodiversity, can you screen your human access to different areas? Can you set one aside for nature and give one to the, I'll be careful what I say, to the people? And they, you know, it's very tough. It's tough for me to, and oftentimes even, you know, one time Lorette was with me at a talk, and a key ally of mine who's done a lot of work with wood turtles and so on, did the same drill and held up his little daughter, and I'm thinking, don't do that. That's important. And I'll go so far as to say, look, what are we doing for the turtles' children's children? Again, using the turtle as that key thing. And it takes a lot out of me to do that, because I commend honestly and sincerely, but I also try to criticize and to guide in a way. And after one particularly difficult evening like that, I felt so good, because the president of the particular land trust, whose annual meeting I was the guest speaker at, the keynote speaker at, in his closing remark said, "We really appreciate David coming here. We always love to hear what he has to say. And indeed, we must not forget that, after all, our mission is to protect habitat and species. And we must think about what we're doing in that regard." And I felt like that took a big load off my mind in that particular afternoon or evening. But you see, that has become hard for me to do. But obviously, my books still have an influence. I've given talks. One of my best experiences ever was I gave a talk in Spanish to 7 men from the Andes who didn't speak English. It's kind of a long story. I won't get into it. But they were very much on the same page I was on. These weren't like people from Lima, Peru. They were from Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, but they weren't from the big cities and all. They were the indigenous people who really actually themselves want to continue their land use practices, their weaving and so forth that they've done. But they also want to have places that are where nature is left alone. In fact, there was a movement in Ecuador to introduce a plank into the new constitution that they were drawing up maybe 2 years ago. I don't know how this played out. I've got to find out. But they had quite a plank in there about the rights of nature, and that it was almost like an equal rights amendment for races, human races. That was extraordinary. A friend of mine who goes down there to do conservation work sent this to me. And then Evo Morales in Bolivia, he came to New York. I wish I could have gone to New York to hear him, but he gave a talk on Los Derechos de Madre Tierra, the rights of Mother Earth. And there are these peoples who see that as an inalienable right, and I feel there's a right. We don't recognize that right. You know, the turtles don't have a lawyer, you know, they don't. It's all the developers and the agencies, and they split and cut and divide, and it's usually quite inequitable, in my estimation, the piece of the pie that actually does go to nature. But it's so easy for us to say, it's a victory for the economy. Well, usually it's not even that. Maybe some people's economy. It's a victory for people, and it's a victory for nature. I want to see a victory for nature. So I continue. I must continue because, you know, I want to. It is a mission, but I'm measuring it more against other things also. And also, having received the kind of recognition I've gotten and the credibility I've received, I can't walk away from that. Typical day in the life of David Carroll is something that I... They all end up being kind of typical, but I start out mostly wrestling with what is this typical day going to be. I end up doing the same old stupid dog tricks. There are two typical days. My typical day is much more easily defined and mapped out, hopefully before noon, in the wintertime. You know, I and my wife both have a tendency to overgarden, and then I'm drawn to the swamps. I'm in the swamps so much in the summer that I don't, you know, I do 90% of my art and writing in the winter. That's beginning to shift a little bit more now because of certain disenchantments that sort of drive me away from the swamps at time, and then I have to go back. So that's a difficulty. But in the winter, typically, I just go up to my Ovest Arbeitszimmer, my Western workroom where I have my drawing and writing tables and tons of things. The East room that I used to use mostly has gotten so piled with books, it's pretty much closed off until I can get in there and do a controlled burn or something. But I sort of fasten my seatbelt and I work on writing. Now it's mostly artwork that I'm working on. The past 2 years, and over the past two winters, I've done an awful lot of drawing and a certain amount of painting. And what writing I do is fragments. I spend time studying these languages. That has become very important to me. And I speak Spanish and Italian, I would say, close to fluently, and German quite well. And I've taken up Russian, which is a huge challenge, very fascinating, very difficult. But for some reason, this is something that seems important to me. And I integrate that into my art also. And what writing I do tends to be fragments in those things. And I try to keep up, you know, something with my notebooks that I, during the summer, I still, you know, in the swamps, during the active season, I do keep notebooks where I record the turtles I find and the things that are going on with them. And some of the turtles in my notebooks have been in there for 25 and 30 years now. And different things that happened in the natural ecosystem, and then different things that happen as human intervention comes into play. So that's all part of it. So if I were working on a book, it gets very much more regimented. I would be up there by 8 or 9 in the morning, and I would be writing. I would write for 10 or 20 or 30 or even 40 days straight until 5 o'clock or so, and then it's martini time, and you put it aside. I put it aside. Then I would draw for 10 or 20 or 30 days. I'd work on a series of drawings that I mapped out while I was doing the writing to accompany the writing. Now I don't have that structure. I have a more free-form writing and drawing agenda. In the summer, in the active turtle season, I mean, it starts with thaw at the end of March and early April. I head out. That's a very compelling time. So I am actually out there. The spotted turtles come out of hibernation very early, and I sometimes have to snowshoe to get to where they're coming out of hibernation in a small pocket in the wetland that they know where to go, that's first to open up. And I'm wading in water that might be 36 degrees, but they come up into the sedges if there's a little bit of open water. And I literally kick off my snowshoes, and I step down from a shelf sometimes of ice that's a foot thick with a foot of snow on it into this water. So from then on, I'm out there. I'm out there a good part of the day. And then I'm out there for the nesting. That first thaw up until mid to late June, when the nesting season ends and the turtles kind of hide out more and things quiet down in terms of their activity until hatching time, which comes at the end of August and September and into early October, that kicks in a little bit more of that wandering. And I'm mostly out there and I'm recording notes. The past 2 years, I've swapped that off with a little bit of more of drawing, actually, during the active turtle time. And it's always easier for me if we have a rainy spell or something like that, because that rules certain things out that aren't there. But this time of year, it is hard. If I'm working on things, I just feel that pull, too, to be out there. And that's, you know, and then in season, I mean, there are chunks of days are spent in the garden, and then a lot of neglect, and then a recovery time. But it's a blend, and I try to devote some time each day to at least one of the languages, and usually two, either just reading a little something or actually studying a little bit, or sometimes in the field I just talk to myself in German or Spanish or something like that. It's a really nice blend. More and more I just feel, as I'm giving less and less talks, another reason is that it's getting very hard for me to. I can be a public figure. I have no trouble speaking, and I'm glad that I'm able to. That's been a very big help to me too. The fact that I can go out, I can give. I was actually class actor as well as class artist in my high school yearbook, so I'm not media shy or anything. And that's been a useful tool for me as well. I mean, it's been very useful because I, in my own way, I've had to sing for my supper too. And so now, and then, of course, with that remarkable and talk about luck, the remarkable telephone call 5 years ago from the MacArthur Foundation and that fellowship, which opened up, just took some financial burdens away, at least for a while, and hopefully we can make it last as long as possible. I'm in my last quarter of that. A huge, huge opening occurs. I don't have to factor in singing for my supper necessarily as much as I did, obviously. And my wife, Lorette, doesn't have to do as many of those shows, which are getting harder to do, putting up all that kind of moving around and everything. I mean, we aren't 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 anymore. Probably very soon not even going to be 60 anymore. So you do think of things. But I try to get up, I try to early, I try to do a little something with a language, and then I try to think about, what's today going to be? What can I? And in German they say, wer die Qual hat, hat der Wahl. Wer die Wahl hat, hat die Qual. Who has choice has suffering, has agony, has angst. And yet I think of the people whose day is mapped out for them. They get up, their day's already, it's work time. You go, you do your job, you get home, you don't have a whole lot of day to yourself. And I don't expect sympathy, but I must say, it's a very difficult thing sometimes to, my whole life has been largely defining my own day, every day. And people said, gee, that must be great, every day's Friday for you, David, they say. I'd say, yeah, but it's Friday without a paycheck, and it's Monday, too. Every day is Monday for me. So it's the way it is. And for example, yesterday, I thought, I made a plan to go up to check on a vernal pool where I was strongly suspecting that Jefferson salamanders that are not commonly found at all. I found this pool that it appeared they were really breeding in pretty heavily this spring. And I just wanted to see if I'd have a chance to find one of the young ones developed far enough to get a recognition of, a positive ID before they leave the vernal pool and take up their terrestrial life. So I went up there with one of my grandsons to visit this pool and indeed managed to successfully net one. And indeed, it was a Jefferson salamander. So there still was that going on. Prior to that, I was out walking where the wood turtle hatching season is in progress, hoping, as I often have at this time of year, to have an encounter with a free-range, nest-to-water-journeying hatchling wood turtle. It's like lights out for me. It's like tremendous. And this spring, there was so much nest predation by the foxes and skunks and so forth that I really felt my odds would be very slender. But I have in the past week twice encountered a turtle each. And to me, that makes practically the whole season, so I do that. But then also I knew I had to get back. We're trying to build, some website stuff to try to be an economic feature as things go on. And I had to get some correspondence done, and I had to prepare some Russian stuff because I'm actually facilitating with a group of three that I incorporated to take a beginning Russian course. But we were the only ones left, and the course couldn't continue, so we're doing it on our own. And I am a de facto facilitator. Boy, that's an interesting thing to do. So that was a good day, though. And I would reference the MacArthur Fellowship one more time. I mean, it is such an extraordinary thing. And just as I wish we could change our attitude toward this preservation of and actually take that as a serious part of our human agenda on the planet, I wish there were more things like the MacArthur Foundation, because that fellowship program, that the so-called genius grant, that when they award that, it is absolutely no strings attached. Who does anything that's no strings attached? I was talking to my German friend about this, who didn't know about this thing, and he said, what do you mean? How much money? What? There's no strings? Nothing, really, truly. He says, tell me. I said, no. I did not even have to go to a dinner to pick it up. Nothing. They call. They tell you that you are, they congratulate you and say that you've been named a MacArthur Fellow. They lay out the terms. The money is taxable. If you perish before the term is up, it's not transferable. You know, they tell you the nuts and boltsy things, but they say, you know, we think the world of what you're doing. They make it clear that I could, in fact, go to Guatemala for the last years of my life and spend the rest of my time writing Spanish surrealist poetry. By the time they give one of those, they feel the candidate is unquestionably going to continue to do something with, and it isn't just art, obviously. I mean, they have medical researchers, they have, it's an amazing array of people. It can be a jazz musician, it can be a dancer. It's phenomenal. And they just say, this is the last you'll hear from us. Good luck. I mean, bingo, the checks will start in January. I mean, my heavens. And for years, people would say, David, you know, with all that stuff you do, why don't you, there's money out there, right? Why don't you write for some grants? Why don't you do this? Well, I happen to know an awful lot of people, particularly in the field biology realm and the conservation realm, who spend so much time writing grants, trying to fund their own positions, going through reams of paperwork. I did write a grant one time. I got a grant with the Nature Conservancy, in fact. I think I got $2,000. I don't know how much paperwork I did. And in the end, I had to agree that supposedly every photo I took, every idea I got in the field, every note I took in my notebook would be their property when I was on their grant. I thought, and I used to say to people, I'm waiting for the MacArthur. Again, I wish, you talk about luck. I mean, I wish people could receive that kind of backing. I mean, we could be doing so much better with our wealth. And this is one thing where wealth that was made by an eccentric billionaire in the insurance business, I guess, Arthur D. MacArthur and Catherine T. And look what they've done for public radio. I mean, and they always say, working towards a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. And they're serious. So I have to say, not only is it just a wonderful thing, it's just wonderful to know that, that there is that thought process somewhere out there in the human brain. And so that was, you know, it was such a recognition also of what I had done. And they do have a bias for people 40 years old or younger. But they do, you know, there's always a sprinkling of ancient people like me in there. I wrecked the age curve the year I got mine at 65, I guess. And so it was, you know, it was an affirmation of what I had done and just a huge, huge enabler of what I might go on to do. And I guess as far as what I've done, the books represent something. There's something really wonderful about a book. I've given talks, I've done field reports, and these are good. But there's something about a book that is so tangible. It is so there. I mean, it has the potential for a certain kind of immortality in the human world, I suppose you could say. I've gotten a few things into the scientific literature, which is very important to me personally also. But I guess the thing I feel really good about too is that with the various phases my life has had, the various great obstacles and economic difficulties and different, you know, different real life problems, and enormous luck just in time, the fact that I've been able to use these talents that I was fortunate enough to have. And I guess the fact that I, no matter what was going on around me, I would stay true to those talents and to developing them. And in a way, I think, well, how could you not? How could you not? That would be grievously wrong if you had this. And, you know, my wife and some of my friends often say, you know, people who know some of the personal circumstances of my life and the less than rosy times would say, you know, I know what you're going through at this time. You still do your stuff. You still draw. You still write. You still go to those swamps. You are undeterred. And again, I guess it's that singleness of purpose, that drive or passion. I'm not sure what. So those things are very, and the body of work that I will have left behind. Somehow in all of this, I've done quite a tremendous amount of artwork, a good deal of which is still in my own collection, but some is out there. And I'm looking for a comeback as boy artist now. I want to get more of that artwork out there.
I keep thinking I don't have much time. I got to catch up with Paul Klee and Pablo Picasso. But seriously, that is something that's important to me too. Now is to return to that branch of what I do, and I will have left behind that, and then the recognition. This is a wonderful thing. I mean, in a way, I've been a voice crying in the wilderness, but I'm not crying in the wilderness because I've had so many articles written about me. I've had so much, you know, video documentary done and so forth. So it is a body I was able to leave behind. And I think, you know, there are people, you know, so many people who do have gifts and talents and who do work very, very hard. They may not have the avenues. They may not have had the opportunity and gotten the kind of recognition I've got. So I am tremendously grateful for that. And because of that too, as long as I can, I have to continue.